All right, good morning. It is 9 o'clock on Tuesday, February 2nd, and we're doing the morning Chem 12 lab. We're just jumping into Canvas to look at the Canvas shell for the morning lab. And I've got a new module that is put together. So this is the morning lab's Canvas shell. If you're joining in the morning, but you're in the afternoon Canvas lab, you don't even have to worry about that because you're only going to see one Chem12BL lab when you log in. You won't see both. I'm just seeing both because I'm in the instructor mode. And when you look at the modules, there is now a Grignard module. And in that Grignard module, I've got an introduction that shows you what it is that we're going to do, all of the steps within the module. And I've actually put some of the links in here, so you could actually link to some of the things in here if you wanted to. I've got the reaction up there that we're doing. First step would be to sort of review experiment 33A in the laboratory textbook. I usually refer to that just by the name of the author, but it's Pavia, but the name of the book is A Microscale Approach to Organic Laboratory Techniques. You're using the textbook to help prepare your laboratory notebook to conduct the experiment. And there's a detailed rubric that explains the required elements of the laboratory notebook on chemed.study. I didn't get the link in there. I'll have to get it. It's on one of the subsequent pages. I'll show you in a minute. Attend and or watch the Zoom pre-lab lecture that was given on the 28th. So that was the last lab lecture that we did. Those are archived here. Watch the videos on conducting the lab, including apparatus setup. And I've split them up into different sections. So there's one on the lab setup, there's one on conducting the reaction, there's one on the reaction workup, and there will be one on product characterization, but I haven't completed that one yet. And then we will have a post-lab lecture class. I was thinking that this would be that post-lab lecture class, but in retrospect, you still need time to be able to watch those videos that are the actual lab videos and to take notes from those as you would within an actual lab. And so that's what I'm going to propose that we utilize this morning's time for, is to allow you guys to go and watch those videos and take notes from those videos. And then we have a write-up, and we'll talk quite a bit about the write-up as we do that post-lab lecture. And I have all kinds of things for you for that write-up. So if we go to the next part in that module. This is part that you may not have done yet, which is getting your laboratory notebook together. And in that laboratory notebook, there's a couple of aids to be able to help you. One of them is here, which is the laboratory notebook rubric. These are the components of a laboratory notebook. You have how organized the laboratory notebook is. You have what I call the heading of an experiment, which includes the title, the purpose, the procedure, a chemical reaction, if that is applicable to the lab. You have a data section where you're taking down all of the data. And then there's a legal component of how you're actually writing in that laboratory notebook and the way in which you interact with the laboratory notebook. So that legal component in the rubric, I've broken them down into categories of mastery, accomplished, adequate, developing, beginning, and what each one of those things look like. This whole legal component and where this comes from looking at documents created by patent attorneys to advise laboratory workers on how to maintain a proper legal laboratory notebook. And if we jump back into Canvas, I linked an article here that was written by the law pat firm Darby & Darby. And it's quite old, but perfectly relevant. And I've used it for years to teach. And in fact, it was what I was given in grad school when I had issues with my laboratory notebook. And so it goes through the following guidelines of the do's and don'ts. What do you do in order to maintain a good laboratory notebook that meets the needs of a legal document? And it has just simple things like you should never erase anything. All entries should be made in a black pen. You should never tear out or remove a notebook page. Each page needs to be signed and dated and witnessed. Every single page, not just the end of the experiment. Every page at the bottom should be signed by you when that page is completed, should be dated on the date that it's complete, and it should be witnessed within a timely manner so that usually at the end of a day, you would go to your supervisor and you would have your supervisor witness each page of your laboratory notebook that you completed for that day. And then there's a bunch of things that should happen. And the way to think of a laboratory notebook, I'm not going to go through all of these. I'll let you go through and read them. And then they talk about what makes a laboratory notebook almost worthless. So they have a bunch of things here that are really not to do. And that's sort of where I took things to create the rubric. One of the things that a laboratory notebook is supposed to be is it is supposed to be a chronological journal of what you do on a daily basis in the lab. It is not supposed to be organized by experiment per se. It is supposed to be organized by time. So oftentimes you'll start an experiment and then you'll start another experiment. And rather than leaving four or five blank pages between the two experiments, it's a chronological record. And so you simply, on the experiment that you're working on, you write two page and you'll come back and you'll fill in that page number that you're going to skip to when you go back to completing that experiment. And on the next page, you start the experiment that you're starting now. And so we oftentimes use to and from fields. Hang on a second. Grab. We oftentimes use to and from fields in order to tell where an experiment is going to and where it came from. Now, I wasn't using those fields in my book, but I think that you might be able to see that here up at the top, it says from page. So this would be a page that maybe came from the previous page, but maybe not. Maybe it came from 10 pages previous. And I would say where it came from. And at the bottom of the page over here, it says to. And this tells you where the next page is that this experiment picks up at, because it's a chronological record of what you're actually working on. And so on this next page, maybe the continuation of this experiment, but maybe not. Maybe I'm jumping around and doing different things. That oftentimes happens in the lab. Let's say that you have two experiments that are ongoing in the lab and you save up all your spectroscopy to be able to go and run all your spectroscopy at the same time. But the data for that spectroscopy is going to go in different places in the laboratory notebook. Well, technically it would go side by side in the laboratory notebook and you refer to it from the experiment that you left off on so that the laboratory notebook becomes a chronological record and we never leave a blank page. The reason for never leaving a blank page in a laboratory notebook is because if at some point the notebook is needed as a legal document and it is pulled into court and there are blank pages in it in between experiments, the question is, what was on those pages? Were they blank? Or was there something that was in there like a spectrum of some molecule or something that was taped into the laboratory notebook that just fell out and is now missing? So it brings up questions because it's not presented as a chronological record if there are blank pages. And we're trying to avoid questions in terms of a legal format. So that's why there's such strict rules around it. There's also really strict rules around deletions and how you delete things, not obliterating things. For instance, in my notebook, on this Grignard experiment that we're doing, I went in to do the Grignard experiment and I completely chunked it towards the end of the experiment on the first day that I did it. So Friday was an all day filming day and I completely blew it. This was the data that I was taking down Friday that rather than totally obliterate all the data, I just drew a line through the page so it can still be read so that you can still see what's underneath. And then my data for the actual experiment that I did picks up on the next page and you just never obliterate anything. So it's natural to make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. The idea is to not entirely obliterate the mistakes and to move on with the correct thing. If it's a whole page, you just strike the page with a diagonal strike. If it is a number, you simply strike the number with a horizontal line and write the correct number next to it. There's no reason or need to obliterate the number to make it unreadable. If you make it unreadable, people want to know what it was. What is it that you were trying to hide? Why were you trying to hide something? What is in the data that needed to be modified to such a degree that you needed to obliterate it and hide it? So those are some of the notebook rules. All right. And maybe while I'm here, and I don't know how well this is going to show you on the screen, it's not easy, I know, to hold up a book and to say, this is what I do in my laboratory notebook. But you can see that I have my title. I have my experiment that we're doing. I have a purpose that I've written out. I have a procedure that I've written out that may include some sketches or drawings of how I'm going to put things together to be able to remind me of what it is that I'm doing. Beyond that, my procedure continues and is written much like a recipe in a very condensed format, line by line, of what it is I need to do. And so the laboratory notebook becomes the guide, per se, and you don't actually need the you don't need the laboratory manual anymore. At this point, you have all the data that you need to have and to be able to proceed. And I have instructions for the workup as well. One other thing that I like to put into my laboratory notebook is a separation scheme. It breaks down, starting at the workup, where everything goes and each step, what is being added and how things are being broken apart. This is a skill that needs to be taught and we'll need to work out and talk about. And I generally have you include a separation scheme with every experiment, not necessarily in your laboratory notebook, but at the end of every experiment, it's part of the work that I ask you to do so that you understand what it is that you're doing at each step. And it's better if you work out the separation scheme before the experiment rather than after. This gives you a clearer image in your mind, chemically, of what is taking place when you're working in the laboratory. So that's a great thing to have. And then of course, you have all of your data that would go into your laboratory notebook, okay? So what I would do is head on over and take a look at those documents, the construction of the laboratory notebook. And then what I've got for you, let me go back to the screen share. What I've got for you in Canvas . This was the pre-lab lecture that we gave. So you all either attended that or watched that already. That part's already completed. These are the videos that I made. And these comprise almost three working labs worth of information that's taking place. And so you would have done an initial lab period where you ran the Grignard reaction. You would have then done an experiment where you worked up the Grignard and another lab day where you would have done the characterization. So this is going to comprise 9 hours worth of time in the lab, 3 lab sessions. And I've condensed it now down into 1 hour and 40 minutes. And there'll probably be another 20 to 30 minutes that is on the characterization itself. That will be a last video. That video I'll go in and I'll try and film tomorrow and try and get up either tomorrow night or Thursday morning. We'll see how that goes in terms of getting that video up. I'm getting faster at it, but it's a lot to try to put these together. And I think you'll see when you watch these videos how much work actually went into putting these things together. So while they're linked in Canvas here, I'll show you that if you jump over to chemed.study, and underneath the Chem12BL, underneath Lab Zoom Recordings, the videos are linked under today's date. So they're all there as well. So you can access them in all sorts of places. Okay, will we be sending pictures, scans of our lab notebooks? Usually what I do is I have a copy of the laboratory notebook pages attached to the formal report. So the formal report comprises the actual report. It comprises any spectroscopy that you take, the actual scans that would be printed from the experiment. Those I'll put online because I'll be making those for you. It has also your separation scheme and then laboratory notebook pages so that I could see how you're actually working within your laboratory notebook. So yes, we'll be putting all those together in a package. And then what I have for you in Canvas is a page here that says to watch the post-lab lecture that we will do on Thursday. And then the final one is the submission page. So here what you do, and I have the formal report guidelines, a formal report rubric, an example of a formal report for you guys to model after so that you can see an older student report that I thought that was pretty darn good that you could take a look at. And then this one has you take them and try to scan them either using an application like TurboScan on your cell phone or on an iPad or on any Android phone. There is also a couple of other scanning applications. And by this time, as you guys have had Chem 1A or Chem 1B and other math classes and things, I'm guessing that you're getting used to finding a way of making PDFs and getting PDFs uploaded. So you have a method that works for you. Whatever method works for you, that's great. Get them into a single PDF and then label that PDF last name, first name, Grignard.pdf. And then in the student version, there will be an upload link that will be in the upper right-hand corner up here. You hit that upload link and upload it and you are done. And that is the Grignard experiment. As far as signatures go, yeah, we're skipping the signatures part. Don't worry about the signatures. You can sign it. You just won't have a witness. That's all that's going to happen. So you should sign and you should date the bottom of each page of your laboratory notebook, but we're going to eliminate the need for a witness signature in terms of what we're doing.
So we're going to write out the procedure and everything just as you've done and then take our like data from the videos that we watch.
Yep. You've got it. So that's what I did in terms of making the video. The video is partly entertaining, but it's also entirely set up for you to be able to take data from the video as we're doing it. And I got a little carried away and got into vlogger mode. And it's pretty hysterical. I mean, I almost hesitate to do this, but... like if you watch the first one. Oh wait, hang on. We need to share sound too. Share screen, share sound, desktop two. Okay. Yeah, I was ridiculous.
Today, that's right. It's lab day, it's Grignard day. So we're gonna do our first reaction. We're gonna do a Grignard reaction. And we're going to be reacting bromobenzene with magnesium metal to make phenyl magnesium bromide. That's our Grignard reagent. And then from there, we're going to take that and we're going to react it with benzophenone to make triphenyl methanol. Before we even get started, we have to first dry some glassware. So that's our first stop is to take a look at the glassware that we need to dry and talk a little bit about the types of joints in these glassware and how the caps and all of that system works on these 1410 joints. All right, I'll see you there in a second.
All right, so I mean, that's the style of the video. And I've got it zoomed in on the chemical reactions really tight so you can see everything that happens. I talk about how to set up the apparatuses, how to do all the transfers, the different ways that we handle pipettes. I do everything that we would have done in the lab in terms of in-person instruction so you can really see how everything is going. And I'm really interested in feedback on how the video goes too, and whether this is working for you guys. And the one thing that I didn't do is clue you in as to what data you should be taking. However, I do let you know, hey, next time I'll see you over at the balance. And so when I'm at the balance, you can assume that you're gonna be recording masses and the things that you need to record. You can pause it and reverse it and watch little segments of it again as you need to in order to be able to catch all that data. This is why I say it's a good thing to read the laboratory manual and prepare your laboratory notebook even before you watch the video, because preparing your laboratory notebook happens before you go into the lab anyway. It takes a look at all the data that is going to need to be taken down and actually creates spaces in your laboratory notebook for that data so that you're just filling in the blanks essentially as you go through the experiment. Some people may be more comfortable doing that fluidly. That's okay too. Some people, as they're going through and doing the experiment and they're saying, all right, I need to go weigh this. And then they write down in their laboratory notebook what it is that they're weighing and the weight right next to it. And then they proceed on to the next step. Perfectly fine to do that in a fluid manner as well. Just sometimes I find that the more preparation that you do ahead of time outside a lab makes lab go a whole lot smoother because you've got 3 hours in which to complete the lab. That includes cleanup and everything. And if you're disorganized, that time evaporates so quickly. And sometimes you don't get everything done that you need to get done in that lab period. So lab favors the prepared and doing as much of that as you can ahead of time. All right. I think that's all I've got for you this morning in terms of putting you on your way and setting you off and letting you explore those Canvas pages and watching those videos and seeing what you come back with. And then what I figured was this is, in terms of videos, this is an hour and 40 minutes worth of time that is here that I think is well served to use that as this morning's time so that I'm not occupying more of your time than I should be, right? Because then I'm sort of double dipping if I'm putting up videos and I'm taking up your lecture time and doing all of that. So I'm counting this as sort of our lecture time and your work outside. And when is the due date for that lab report? That is a great question. I think if you move on over to here and you look at the date that I set, nope, that is not it. I think I set it for 2 weeks. Come on. Due date, February 16th. So I set it up so you got 2 weeks in order to be able to do this. With the separation scheme, I was going to talk more about the separation scheme on Thursday. I certainly could do that now. That's not a bad thing to do now in drawing out what happens with the separation scheme. But I need to share in a different format to be able to do that. In doing a separation scheme, separation schemes start from the first point when you take materials and put them into two different containers. So the entire time you're doing an experiment, you're combining things. You're putting things together. Hang on a second, I want to get windows moved around. Complicated. There we go. I like to be able to see you guys while I'm talking. At least if I can see some faces, that helps me. Okay. Separation schemes. Is it scheme? C-H-E-E-M? E-M-E? In a separation scheme, what we're doing is we are showing where all components go in the isolation phase of the experiment. It starts at the first point where you take two things and separate them into two different containers. So the entire time we're doing the experiment, we're adding reagents, we're adding solvents, we're adding components to accomplish the chemical reaction. At some point, the chemical reaction is over and we start taking it apart and we start putting it into different containers. At the point where you take two things apart, that's where a separation scheme starts. And so it starts at the first point of separation. And it should list all components that are in the reaction at that point. Now, sometimes what happens is as you're doing a separation scheme, chemical reactions actually happen during the separation scheme. For instance, protonations or deprotonations, acid-base types of things happen during the separation scheme. That is common. And for our reaction gets split up into starting materials. So the starting materials that we used were bromobenzene. We had magnesium metal and we had benzophenone. So those were the three starting materials, but we also made the Grignard reagent, which could be considered to be a starting material as well. You have your solvents. This is, for us, the diethyl ether. And you have side products or contaminants that may have arisen from the chemical reaction. For us, that molecule is benzene. That came from the Grignard reagent reacting with water. So that made a little bit of benzene by pulling a proton. And the other side product that happens for us, that is a fairly large side product, is what's called biphenyl. Biphenyl comes from the reaction of the Grignard reagent reacting with the bromobenzene starting material. And this one acts as the nucleophile, knocking out the bromide, combining them to be able to make the biphenyl. So that's where that biphenyl comes from. This is not an SN2, but it's an SNAR. It's what's called SNAR. Stands for substitution nucleophilic aromatic. And it's an SNAR reaction that gives rise to that. So that's where that one comes from. And then to start the separation scheme, what we do is we put a downwards line, a curving incoming arrow, and this is the reagent that causes the separation that we add here. In this case, it would be 6 molar HCl. That causes two phases to be generated. It causes an aqueous phase. Actually, I take that back. It causes three phases. Sometimes it's not only two, sometimes it's three. So we'll have a gas phase, an aqueous phase, and an organic phase. In the gas phase, this is where magnesium metal is reacting with water to produce hydrogen gas. In the aqueous phase, we have water, we have the HCl, and we will have magnesium salts which will be magnesium 2 plus, combined together with many different anions. These could be bromides and chlorides. And so oftentimes what I'll do is I'll just list it as that there are counter ions that are along with this. This is the bromides and the chlorides that are all sort of mixed salts that are in there. And so we could list it out that bromide is also a counter ion that is ionic, that is showing up in that aqueous phase. And also diethyl ether is pretty darn soluble in water. So we're gonna lose a little bit of our diethyl ether that's gonna go into the water. And if you were to smell the water after the extraction, you would definitely smell diethyl ether in that aqueous component. And then in the organic, we have the diethyl ether and all of the organic all of the organic components or organic molecules. Now, when we list them out, I like to draw them by structure, but sometimes that can get really big. And so sometimes you might just want to use the name, but by structure helps me to visualize what it is that I'm doing. And so you don't want to draw too big over here, otherwise your separation scheme gets massive. But our bromobenzene, our biphenyl, our benzene, oops, this one is the biphenyl, the other one was benzophenone. Oh, and there's something that's missing that I didn't get drawn into this. You guys didn't stop me. The product that we're actually making. And in this case, what we made, we'll have to sneak it in over here. At this point in the reaction, what we made was not triphenyl methanol, but triphenyl methoxide that had the bromide and the magnesium as counter ions. And so that was the product that we had made. And the point of going through and doing the acidification is to acidify that alkoxide, turning into a neutral organic molecule, which then shows up on the organic side. And so when we draw it over here, we draw it not as the anion, but we draw it as the neutral alcohol, triphenyl methanol. Okay, so that's the first step in the separation phase and the separation scheme. And so like I said, sometimes there are chemical reactions which are occurring. For instance, the protonation of this guy, which changes its species into where everything is going, but everything that is up here should be accounted for down here, solvents and all. And the other thing that makes it in here with this diethyl ether is there's a little bit of water that we're going to have to get rid of. All right, after you do the 6 molar hydrochloric acid, the next step in our separation scheme would be to go through and to add in the saturated sodium chloride solution. And this makes two phases. It makes an aqueous phase and an organic phase. And the purpose of the saturated sodium chloride was to draw down some of this water and draw out some of the water out of the reaction. And so what happens is we get water over here, sodium chloride goes over here. We lose a little bit more diethyl ether, but that's all that's coming out in the aqueous. Everything else now remains in the organic phase. And in that organic phase, we redraw everything else. I'm gonna write small amount of water that is now over here because we've reduced down the water. But all these organic components are still in this reaction. Benzophenone. And then we've got the two contaminants, benzene and biphenyl. And then our product, triphenylmethanol. Sometimes these may span over several pieces of paper in order to draw them out efficiently. But you can see that it really does help to visualize each step and what is being accomplished by each step that you do in the workup. It allows you to see where everything is going. After this, the next thing that we add is we add in anhydrous magnesium sulfate. And that creates two phases, but this time we get a solid and a liquid. So our phases change. They can be sometimes things such as aqueous and organic, but they could also be solid or liquid or gas, or whatever it is the phase that is helping us to separate these things. And what we get out of this is magnesium sulfate heptahydrate, which is a solid that binds our water and removes the water from the chemical reaction, drying the reaction. And so now we have dry diethyl ether and all the other components. Okay, after we do the mag sulfate step, the next thing in the procedure is to rotovap. So how do we demonstrate a rotovap and what a rotovap does in a separation scheme? The way that I typically do that is with the capital D in the Greek alphabet delta, which symbolizes heat. So this means heat. And that heat, in this sense, is being generated and used from the rotovap. This is going to separate out two things into a gas and a solid. And for the gas, we're going to pull off diethyl ether as we evaporate it from our vessel. That removes the solvent, and we're left then with all of the solid organic components. Is this making sense as we're going through it? You guys doing all right? Sometimes I get going too long and just talking and thinking I'm making sense, and Hopefully that's true. Okay, now my product is not gonna, well, it'll fit here. I'll sneak it onto this last page. Onto the bottom of this page here. Okay, after the rotovap, the next part is the trituration. And the trituration is where we use petroleum ether to separate out things which are polar and nonpolar. So from here, we would take and we add into it petroleum ether. And remember that this is something like C5 through C7 isomers. It's not a molecule that I can draw that is a single molecule, but it is rather a boiling fraction of hydrocarbon that we use. And we get here not an aqueous, but a liquid phase. And we get a solid phase. And in the liquid, we get the petroleum ether. And in the liquid also goes all of the less polar constituents, the bromobenzene, the benzophenone, the benzene itself, the biphenyl, and then for the solid, we end up with primarily our triphenylmethanol. And then the book recommends one more step beyond this, which is to recrystallize this. And so what I oftentimes do when I get down to this last step before recrystallization is I say impurities. That there may be some residue of these things remaining that are in with this. And the recrystallization then takes care of that. So the recrystallization, the way that I would do it is I would say isopropanol, or you could write it out as 2-propanol. And this is a recrystallization step where we end up with a liquid and solid. And in that liquid, we end up with the 2-propanol and the impurities. And in our solid, we end up with our triphenylmethanol. And we have completely gone through the separation scheme of where everything goes. And what's also really nice about this is it can help you figure out not only where everything goes in every step that needs to be accomplished, but it can help you with your waste streams in knowing what things are being thrown away and where they need to go. Because it helps to identify the phase or state of that waste that is being gotten rid of. This is going to be 2-propanol and impurities. This is going to go into organic waste. Petroleum ether and all these organics. This is going to go into organic waste. Up here, this diethyl ether will go into organic waste eventually when it's captured. The solid mag sulfate with the heptahydrate, this will go into solid waste because it's a solid. The aqueous will go into aqueous waste. And so everything is identified out and where it all goes in the separation scheme. And now it's really hard to show that whole separation scheme from start to finish, but that's it. So we've got a view of all the steps that comprise that separation scheme and where everything goes. Gives you a much better feel and understanding of what you're accomplishing at each step of the chemical reaction, which is why it's a good idea to do it before you do the reaction, while most students are still learning, tend to do it afterwards. Okay. So figuring out where to start, it's the first time you take and put things into two different containers. That's where you start a separation scheme. What goes in it? Everything that you can think of that went into that chemical reaction and the products and any side products that could have possibly been made. So we're keeping track of those as well. Okay, questions, thoughts, concerns? Overwhelmed, panic? No, we're doing okay. Everybody's doing okay.
I do have a question about these. Okay. Are you gonna work with us? Like, are we going to have these as an assignment to do by ourselves, or is this something that you're going to work with us on for a little bit before?
Usually I work on it with you. But as we progress through these, they should get easier. And so what I'll help you do is identify everything that is in the chemical reaction and side products and what's coming up, and then give you a chance to try to work on the separation scheme to building it out.
Awesome. Because it's definitely something, I mean, I haven't seen it before. So I think coming up with the starting point is the hardest part.
I agree. Usually I start teaching these when we do the aspirin lab in the first semester of organic chemistry lab. So that aspirin synthesis lab, if you guys talked about that, would have been the first place that I really start to introduce a separation scheme. And then we have a couple more reactions in that second semester where we do them. And so by this point, students are usually comfortable, but I completely understand that that may not have happened, and that's okay. Not a concern. And we'll give you all the help you guys need to get through these. All right. I'm not going to leave you hanging at any point. And if things aren't making sense, all you need to do is either ask me in the middle of class and I'll break it down, or jump into office hours at some point and I'll be more than happy to work through it with you. I'll never leave you hanging. Okay. All right, you guys feel comfortable maybe jumping over and taking a look at those videos and seeing how that lab is put together and run? All right, and we're going to have another day on this yet. We'll come together on Thursday and we'll talk about the data and talk more about the lab, and we'll talk more about the write-up so that you're not being left hanging for the write-up either. All right, it's hard to get it all into one class. I know there's lots of questions maybe yet as to what it is that you need to do. But for today, what you need to do is watch those videos, get down some data, and maybe even take a look at what some of those numbers mean in terms of what percent yield you saw in the final product come out of that chemical reaction, which means trying to calculate your limiting reagent out of the three reagents that were used, find the limiting one, and use that as a basis for determining the percent yield of the final product. Bringing back some Chem 1A and Chem 1B skills, hopefully without panic. All right, let me know what you need. So if you're thinking about any other questions here, I'll hang out for a little bit. If anything comes to mind.
Hey, Jason, I had a couple questions.
Sure.
So I don't have the lab book yet, but I was planning on getting it. Do you suggest waiting to watch them until I have the book, or?
No. Keegan, I think you can jump right in and do what you need to do. I mean, we outlined this experiment in our first lab lecture that we did. And so if you go back and you just look over that lab lecture and the lab lecture notes, it outlines each step and pretty much everything you need. I don't think you'll need the book, because I'm going to explain it in so much detail in the video, you're going to be fine.
Okay.
I'd go watch the videos.
Okay. I also have an unrelated question. It's kind of random. Do you think like this whole online format over the course of a year or two will like significantly impact our ability, like job wise, when we get out of college?
Well, it depends on what job you want to have. If you're trying to have a job where you work in a research lab, then that could have some impact in that, because the lab skills are going to be somewhat lacking as you go through. But I think that, you know, we're all going to have to make some readjustments when we come back into person and back into working. And if your theory is strong in terms of what you're learning in the class, picking up those lab skills is not it's not like you've missed out on a whole thing of education that you can't learn that skill. Those lab skills can be taught within a research lab working with a partner, and they can be picked up very quickly. So onboarding and making sure that students have the proper skills to be able to do things, I don't think is going to be, I mean, we're going to have to be cognizant that that's what we're going to have to do, but I don't think it's going to prevent people from being hired and yeah, moving into the workforce. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome. All right. If that's it, I suggest we adjourn, and I'll see you guys in lecture this afternoon. Esmeralda, did you have a question, or are you kind of hanging out there?